Hi, this is Dr. David Stevens, your host for Christian Doctor's Digest. And, you know, we've got something for everyone in this issue. I'm excited about it. We're going to start out talking about the misuse of science for political purposes. Science is so respected in our culture, but it can be misused. And we're going to talk about that and some of the impact that it's having on people in our country, including us. And then we're going to go to look at another practice model. We've kind of had this series going for a number of issues. We're going to look at executive medicine as a practice model. And you may not really understand what that is. You're going to know more after this interview. And then Ron Blue's going to join us for a good talk on how much is enough. I've actually been thinking about this and how much is enough to pass on to my kids. And what should I be doing about charities in my will? And Ron's got some really wonderful insights that help me, and I know they're going to help you. It's a great lineup. Let's get to it. It's great to have Dr. John West with me here at the microphone. John's a vice president and senior fellow at the Seattle-based Discovery Institute and serves as their associate director for their Institute Center for Science and Culture. He's currently really focusing on examining the impact of science and scientism on public policy and culture. He's got a rich background to do that. He has a PhD in government from Claremont Graduate University, a BA in communications from the University of Washington. He served as the associate professor of political science at Seattle Pacific University and chair of the Department of Political Science and Geography there. He's written over 12 books, and today we're really going to look into one of those. It's called Darwin Day in America, How Our Politics and Culture Have Been Dehumanizing in the Name of Science. It's a fascinating topic. You're really going to get some great information. John, it's so good to read your book, Darwin Day in America. And what kind of motivated you to do this? And then why is it so important?
Well, I've been intrigued by the impact of science on culture for a long time. I think that interest was fed by reading people like C.S. Lewis, Francis Schaeffer, G.K. Chesterton, and then certainly when I went to graduate school and seeing a lot of the claims being made in the name of science that really impacted every area of our life. And so this has intrigued me for a long time. And as to why it matters, I really think that in our current culture, science, which is a very good thing, but it has been stretched beyond, say, it's where it should be, and to some people actually is pretty much their God or their religion, and so that has opened us up to people misusing science and basically making all sorts of claims in the name of science because they think if they say science says so, then everything else has to fall in its path, whether it be core traditional moral beliefs, religious beliefs, cultural beliefs, that, you know, if they say science says so, then they have the ultimate trump card. And we're seeing this in everything from, you know, human sexuality to our moral beliefs to theories of personal responsibility and personal accountability. And so what I do in my book is actually trace not only some of the origins of these ideas, but then how they've impacted economics, welfare, criminal justice, bioethics, end-of-life issues, beginning-of-life issues, human sexuality, education, and just showing just how influential these claims made in the name of science can be and how discerning we need to be. And, you know, the thing is, people who are scientists or doctors or people who are trained, they know that science sometimes does clearly say things and, you know, our knowledge progresses, but there are many times where things are a little more muddy and also where people are going way beyond what the evidence says. So I think especially those who are scientifically trained, who actually know the details of some particular area, they recognize that. But in our broader culture, this is a problem.
How do we get in this mess? I mean, where did I know in your book you talk clear back to Plato and Aristotle, but let's kind of jump up into the 1800s, where this really took root and began to affect culture significantly, and kind of lay the framework and explain what you're actually saying by scientific materialism so we make sure we're all operating from the same understanding.
Yeah, well, to understand scientific materialism, we do need to understand even just materialism, which is the idea that we're just the product of blind matter and motion. So there is no soul, there's nothing that, you know, survives death, that morality is just sort of an epiphenomenon of our of the material inputs that we get and our material cravings. So there is no transcendent morality. Really, we don't have any personal responsibility or accountability because, again, we're just blind matter in motion. Now, there have always been that debate, as you pointed out. Actually goes back to the ancient Greeks, at least. But where I talk about scientific materialism is the effort to justify this view in the name of science. So there have always been philosophers and thinkers sort of on the fringe of society trying to offer a completely materialistic account of humanity and nature. But by in the 1800s especially, you had the rise of people in the name of science saying that now, in the name of modern science, we can actually prove this. And one of the formative thinkers, not the only one, but one of them was Darwin. And that's actually why the book is called Darwin Day in America, is because he really was one of the big guys in making this case of saying that, you know, the old materialism is not just philosophical, but now actually science proves it. And so more particularly what you see in Darwin's theory is, you know, the claim that basically human beings are no more than animals, that human progress is dependent not on sort of the design of a beneficent creator, but on the raw struggle for survival, and that's sort of our creator. And in a really strange and really kind of sad way, Darwin makes death and destruction our creator, because for him, the engine of progress is mass death. And that's, you know, the fittest survive from that. And all of our best capabilities that we have as human beings were produced by mass death. And if you think about it, and that is a really sick, certainly from a Christian standpoint, but even I think non-Christian standpoint, to make mass death the agent of all that's good. I mean, he actually has a passage in The Origin of Species where he basically says, from things like, you know, struggle, famine, starvation, war, you know, we get the highest, you know, mammals are produced. I mean, he makes that the creator. Then, of course, you have on the subject, does God exist? Now, I don't think Darwin's theory directly refutes God. On the other hand, by claiming that we're the product of a blind and purposeless process of basically random variations acted on by natural selection, it does certainly point in the direction, if you, they claim that scientifically we can show we're the product of blind and purposeless processes. If that's true, well, that's not a definitive logical refutation of God. It certainly makes the idea of God a lot less plausible. And this is why, say, arch-atheist, Darwinist, former Oxford University professor Richard Dawkins says that Darwin helped us become intellectually fulfilled atheists. And so there certainly is a connection there. So, you know, Darwin really helped get into a lot of different areas. And I think that a lot of people, Christians included, think, well, you know, Darwin had the scientific theory. It's out there. Some people have sort of maybe made some claims in it. But they don't get just how central Darwin's claims, especially that the history of life was a blind and unguided process, which is really Darwin 101, and that we basically can offer material accounts of everything. Darwin actually wrote a book called The Descent of Man, where he gave a very materialistic account of religion and of morality as being simply the product of this struggle for survival. Basically, the morals that we have today aren't sort of inherently true. It's just because they had a survival value for our particular ecological niche. And that's true of any moral beliefs throughout history, and frankly, immoral beliefs too, if you take the Darwinian account of morality to its logical conclusion. So I don't think people recognize just how consequential Darwin's theory has been for every part of our culture.
Ideas have consequences. So what happened? I mean, and let's get into some of those areas. Maybe kind of just looking at it general in the last part, first part of the last century and some of those things, and then what we're dealing with today, and we'll dig in maybe into law and education and medicine, which is of interest to all of us. But, I mean, the eugenics movement came out of this in the early 1900s and up, of course, to what happened during World War II.
It did, and I'd say, so there's a lot of influence on the medical discipline in various areas. And I think it's important for current doctors and those becoming doctors and scientists to really understand the eugenics crusade. So eugenics was the idea that we could basically breed a better race, and it was based on Darwinian principles. The underlying, if you read, and I document extensively from primary resources, the thought was, and this actually goes back to Darwin himself, if human beings got the capabilities that we have now because of survival of the fittest, basically, in modern society, we have a problem because we do everything to counteract survival of the fittest. As Darwin said, he lamented that we try to save the sick till the very last, we help the poor, we inoculate people against smallpox, all of which, in his mind, were basically preserving people that nature would have killed off, and so this was going to destroy the human race. So Darwinism sort of provided the problem, and so then there were two ways you could try to solve it. One, you could go back to the old law of the jungle and just not be compassionate, but Darwin wanted to be more compassionate, and so the other option was, well, let's try to reinstitute something like natural selection artificially through eugenics, and that would be more compassionate than natural selection. So, you know, sometimes people say, well, eugenics, because it was breeding, you know, that wasn't Darwinism because it was artificial. But what they don't get is that the Darwinists offered it as a milder, kinder approach because they wanted to be kind. They fully recognized that the reason we were in the problem, in their view, was we were counteracting natural selection. You know, many scientists I encounter, they think, oh, eugenics, this is just bad science of the time. It was promoted primarily by politicians and people who didn't really know much about science. Well, there were, of course, politicians who promoted it, and they passed forced sterilization laws and things. But the amazing thing, and really the untold story for many scientists today when they actually get trained in the history of science, they don't get told that, in fact, the leading people who pushed eugenics for, you know, 4 or 5 decades and who pushed forced sterilization laws and other things were the leading top evolutionary biologists at Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Columbia, the head of the National Academy of Sciences, many doctors, when you look at the debates over forced sterilization and some other things in various states. And really, the only people who stood against it were Catholics and some evangelical Christians. Evangelicals at that time were less politically active than some of the Catholics, and they were derided, particularly the Catholics. As, you know, they're making this a Catholic issue, and this, they're just trying to shove their religion down our throats, and this, they're anti-science. I mean, a lot of the lingo you hear today on the life issues and other things really were developed, that rhetoric was developed out of the 4 or 5 decades of eugenics. And now today, anyone who looks back on eugenics, they will say, oh, that was junk science. But what they don't say is that for the time, you had all, it was the consensus view of science and the medical community for decades. And really, it was the horrors of the Nazi Holocaust post-World War II when people looked at that really killed at least the explicit eugenics. I mean, I would argue that there are things like eugenics going on today, but certainly eugenics, under the name of eugenics, was largely killed because people were revolted by what they saw in the Germans really taking this to the next stage. So that was very consequential. And the thing is, the medical and scientific community, it wasn't just the non-scientists, it was the medical doctors and the scientists who were, in many cases, supported and enthusiastically. And I think this is a cautionary tale to be discerning, even among, you know, scientists and medical doctors.
Let's talk about the impact that's had today. I mean, because these ideas continue, sometimes the words used are different, but what's been its impact? Let's look just at law, crime, those type of areas. What's happening in our court system of, you know, that we're just products of our environment and, you know, my genes made me do it.
Yeah, I have sections on that in the book, and certainly the debates over human responsibility and whether we're just the product of genes and environment and nothing else, certainly Darwinian theory, but just a general sort of scientific materialism played into that. And the interesting thing is, and again, people with scientific training who've looked into this, if you actually look into the studies, the interesting thing is, yes, there are certainly correlations that can be drawn based on certain genetic and other things, but what's interesting is the correlations are never anything near, you know, 0.9 or above. They're, you know, a strong correlation could be 0.2 or 0.3, and so the interesting thing to me is the vast amount that isn't explained by that. So even today, with all of our knowledge, I think that many of those claims go beyond. But probably one of the most really sad and consequential areas today that really flows out of this is the whole area of human sexuality and family life.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes back a few decades. Many people don't know that sort of the father of the sexual revolution, Alfred Kinsey, was originally trained as an evolutionary biologist at Harvard, and that was his training. And so that really impacted how he tried to remold how we think about sexuality. He had a very Darwinian approach, which is basically whatever you find in nature, and even in any subpopulation in nature, must have at some point been favored by natural selection because it must have had some survival value. And so it's hard for you to actually pick and choose. So if you can find some subpopulation in nature that does something, whether it be bestiality, which you wrote about, you name it, then that's equally natural with everything else, and in his view, basically equally moral. You shouldn't be, you really can't pick and choose. You know, if you can find it somewhere in nature, either in human beings or in the rest of the mammalian population, then it's equally moral. That really has provided the agenda for the breakdown of the traditional sexual ethics in our country, and we're seeing that today, even more broadly speaking. But there was a New York Times bestseller just a couple of years ago called Sex at Dawn, that really by two evolutionary psychologists who are trying to make this argument that man particularly, but the human beings were designed to be, not really designed, but were programmed by evolution to be naturally polygamous and to have multiple partners, and that so marriage is biologically, it's against our biology. So they don't just want to redefine marriage, say same-sex marriage or something else, that marriage itself, in their view, has to be redefined, just a series of however many partners you want for how little or much time you want, because our biology dictates that. That was a New York Times bestseller. And so this idea is very much with us, and particularly the Darwinian connection to it. So I think people really need to get on top of some of these claims, because they're not true claims, for one, but they are working themselves out. I mean, if people think what we're seeing now in the redefinition of marriage is where it ends, they're sadly mistaken. I mean, if you actually read the literature right now where people are trying to push things, it makes the current things seem quaint and prudish, which is really scary.
Let's get over to medicine and just touch on that briefly. Issues of life and death have been affected by scientific materialism. Let's touch on that, and then we'll wind it up. There's so much good stuff in your book. We're just barely touching the surface of it. And really recommend our members get a copy and read it. But let's take a look at those areas.
It's interesting to follow the rhetoric of how we came to believe that babies in the womb are less than human. And if you actually follow the intellectual pedigree of those ideas, it actually traces back to eugenics. But in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, you had a common argument, not just popularly, but even by a geneticist from the National Academy of Sciences, that basically we replay the history of evolution in the womb. And so that, if you get rid of a baby who is young enough, they're in the fish stage of evolution, so it's not like getting rid of a human. This actually goes back to a German biologist named Ernst Haeckel. Among embryologists, it has been regarded as junk science for a long time, but it was very influential in arguing that babies in the womb really aren't human beings. And so that's one area. I would again go back to the human sexuality, because doctors often see the real people get hurt,
right,
in these views, and doctors have to try to deal with the consequences of certain behaviors. And so that is really an area that I think people need to get a grip on now. And where it's going now, and this book that I wrote has just been reissued in an expanded paperback with a new chapter about things happening sort of in the last 5 years. And one of the scary things on the horizon that I write about in my book is this whole area of kids who are sexually confused about their gender or their orientation, and the movement claimed in the name of science, but it really isn't based on science, to restrict counselors and doctors, for that matter, from being able to help kids who are sexually confused, Christian kids. I mean, we've had cases. There was a case of a young Catholic man in New Jersey who was really didn't feel good being a boy and had all sorts of struggles. They found a licensed counselor who was able to help him. He had been suicidal, but helped him consistent with his moral beliefs, because he didn't want to, he didn't like what was going on. He knew somehow that it wasn't right or wasn't healthy how he was viewing things. Well, then New Jersey passed a law basically making it illegal for any licensed counselor to provide that help. Unless you're going to affirm whatever they're feeling, if they're struggling and actually don't even, they don't like how they're feeling and want a better way to deal with it, it's now illegal for a licensed therapist to do that in New Jersey and in California and in Washington, D.C. And these are now being put in dozens of states. It hasn't passed yet. I think one of the most things that the doctors who are Christians need to think about is, in their state, how they can act on this matter, because this goes back to some really false claims about who we are sexually and how that male and female doesn't matter and that our biological design doesn't matter, and it's going to hurt the most vulnerable among us. And there, in many of these states, there aren't religious exemptions. So it doesn't matter if you're a doctor who's a Christian or even work for a Christian organization. It doesn't matter. You won't be able to help kids.
Yeah. We see this continued pressure on religious liberty and right of conscience. It keeps getting worse, it seems, by the week. Let's talk about end of life and this whole view of death and those type of things.
Once you have the idea that all we are is matter in motion, so then if your physical capabilities degrade, you're not there anymore, and you're not valuable anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really, people are written off. And you know, often this is done in the name of compassion, but when you actually look at the actual cases of what this results in how we treat people, I think that you see it's anything but compassionate. Now, I will say, and I make clear in the book, and doctors certainly know this, there is a difference between someone who is in a dying process. You do not have to extend their life indefinitely, and we're not called to do that if you're in the dying process. But there's a difference between prolonging the dying process and then curtailing someone who's living because you think that they're not worthy of life. And, you know, I understand that there are difficult situations that you sometimes have to weigh things, but... And for example, I think, you know, for myself, there have been some on the pro-life side a certain time, even such things as, you know, we have to resuscitate people, you know, 50 times or something, and you know, that's what being pro-life means. And I don't think that that's the case. If people's systems are shutting down and that they're drawing to the conclusion of a natural end of their life and they don't want that unnecessarily prolonged, you know, I think it's a legitimate question of how much, you know, treatment you get. But that's really not what you're seeing here now. I mean, you're seeing people who are not in the dying process, who are being deprived of basic medical care. And in many cases, when it comes to the end of the life, there is good evidence to believe that these people are suffering. I mean, if you're being deprived of liquids and of food, you're not going to have a good outcome. And the misdiagnosis of people with, and I hate the term, I just think, of persistent vegetative state. No human beings are a vegetable. And even using that term, I think, is really unhelpful and wrong. But the cavalier diagnosis of that in some institutions, and I go through some of the studies in Britain and elsewhere that show the percentage of wrong diagnosis of people who, in fact, are aware, who may be being deprived of food and water, really should be concerning to people.
Well, John, thank you so much for taking time. As I said before, we've touched the top of the waves here of what you've written, but thank you for your persistence on this issue. I know this book came over many years as you studied and collect information, and every chapter is almost a book in itself. I really trust our members will get a hold of it, take the time to read it. I think it'll help them understand what's happening in our country, what has caused this, but even more importantly, how we as Christian scientists, as physicians and dentists and other people in healthcare need to be voices of righteousness in our culture and really understand where we came from and where we are now so we can speak for an alternative in how we see the world and how we see healthcare.
I think you're exactly right about the importance of doctors, Christian doctors and Christian scientists, really boning up on this and learning about what's happening so that they can be voices. I can't emphasize that enough. When the claims are being made, the false claims, the misleading claims in the name of science, the people who are most effective in pushing back at that in a discerning way are those with medical and scientific training. So I just hope that the people who are listening, those of you who are called to medical careers or scientific career, realize your special calling, not only in ministering to the people that you're ministering to individually, but at a societal level, you can be a powerful voice on behalf of religious liberty, on behalf of a good discerning use of science, and against false claims made in the name of science, which are in many cases junk science. You know, people are going beyond that. You have a special calling. I just want to encourage you that it goes beyond the individuals that you treat to the wider society.
You're absolutely right, John, and you couldn't have preached it better. Thank you. And the other thing I'd say in the book, you know, I was amazed. Almost half of this book is primary references. So yep. This is a ammo book, a book of ammo to give you the scientific studies and the original studies in sociology and other areas that will help you speak out with authority and write with authority. So John's done the hard work, and now it's our turn. John, thanks so much for being with us, and we sure appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, John's got a great list of books. We've talked about Darwin's Day in America, available on Amazon. Another one that really intrigued me, The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. He's got a wealth of resources, has really done the legwork to give you some great information that is well-referenced as you make the case in the public square. We also have some great resources here at CMDA that you may want to take a look at in the same vein. One of my favorites is by John Lennox, God and Stephen Hawking, Whose Design Is It Anyway? Just a small book, but great information for responding to evolution and some of the issues there. When it really gets into scientism and those issues. And then another favorite book of mine is by John Kilner, Why the Church Needs Bioethics, A Guide to Wise Engagement with Life's Challenges. This is a great book to give to your pastor. It's also one you should have on your bookshelf. Just in a very practical way, helps you engage the culture on some of the bioethical issues we face. Hey, listen, get a couple of these books, stick them next to your bedside table. As you go to bed at night, read a chapter, and guess what? You'll get smarter every day. And to get those, go to cmda.org or give us a call at 888-230-2637. It's always great to have Jamie Campbell here, our Vice President of Stewardship, to give us some great practical advice on dealing with our finances. We want to help you to be good stewards. And we're going to get into a couple topics today that I think be especially helpful. Jamie, great to have you with us.
Thanks, Dave. I want to take a few minutes today to talk about reviewing your estate plan. I know you're in the process of that, and it's something that a lot of people, it's kind of a set it and forget it kind of thing.
Well, it is true, and I know that's been the case for us. I went back and pulled out our stuff and found out, you know, I made it when the kids were still here, and there were a couple things that needed to change, including that my money was going into trust fund still for my youngest daughter. Well, she's plenty mature enough to handle that already, so we're going to change some things and also looking at where the money's going to go and at what percentages.
Sure, and what we see sometimes is people pass away and in their will that they did 40 years ago, it's just not set up to handle the changes in family situations or tax law that's changed since then.
Well, give us some advice. What are some practical things we need to know?
Well, there's not really a hard and fast rule about how often to review your plan. Number one, you need to have a plan. If you don't have one, you need to have one. You need to take a look over it annually. Tax laws change every year, usually around December 31st, unfortunately. And we suggest when we talk to folks that they take a really hard look at it about every 5 years.
So what are some other reasons that you might want to review your plan other than just the calendar?
Well, that's a good point. Some of the things you may want to look at, of course, marital status changes. Somebody gets married, somebody gets divorced. That makes an impact on your plan. What about new children? What about children who no longer need your help?
Yeah.
Grandchildren, those kinds of things. There's been an addition to your family through birth, adoption, marriage, your spouse or family member has died or become ill, incapacitated. That certainly makes a difference. your spouse or your parents, your other family members have become dependent on you. We're seeing that a lot these days. There's been a substantial change in the value of your assets. You've received a sizable inheritance, any kind of major life change kind of thing. One that we see a lot here at CMDA, we see more and more, of course, physicians retiring, and that changes their income and their outflow expectations many times.
Good points, and lots of kind of red flags to say, hey, pull that out, take another look at it. And one of the great things that we're able to do is point people in the right direction to help them do that, which is helpful as well. What else do you have to share with us?
Well, one thing that's been in the news as of late and seems to be causing quite a stir in the estate planning world is the recent Supreme Court decision regarding same-sex marriage. Same-sex couples will now have the ability to plan their estates under the same laws that heterosexual couples have for years. And a lot of experts are predicting a wave of new laws and tax changes as a result because current laws were never designed to accommodate same-sex couples. Don't know what that means. Don't know what it's going to look like, but we're watching it. It could be beneficial in general tax planning kind of situations, but that's the prediction in the days ahead.
Wow, never even really thought of that. Well, the good thing is you're available for people if they've got questions, and you're keeping up with this stuff every day. And if people want to get a hold of you, then give us a call here at our toll-free number, 888-230-2637. And we're happy to help, and we've got some great resources that we can put into your hands or people we can refer to you to help you with specific issues.
Absolutely. We're happy to talk to anybody about any part of their estate planning process.
And this isn't just to benefit us. This is to benefit you and help you along that path to being a great steward, which is one of our goals as the organization. Jamie, thanks for being with us. Appreciate you.
Yes, sir. My pleasure.
One of the joys I have as the CEO of CMDA is getting out there and meeting our members, and there's so many fascinating stories. I'd love to sit down sometime with you and hear that story that you have. Recently, I was with David Player. David's an internist, a nephrologist. He practices in San Antonio, Texas. He's cared for thousands of patients with diabetes and kidney disease. He's been involved with 2,000 patients who've had kidney or heart transplants, just a remarkable career. But his focus now is on teaching patients a lifestyle of wellness. He does this through his organization called Health by Design. And so I wanted to hold this up as another kind of unusual model as we look at other ways to practice medicine here in our country in these changing times. You're going to enjoy getting to know David. Dave, it's great to have you on Christian Doctors Digest. We were just together a few weekends ago when I was down in San Antonio, and out of that chat, I thought, I've got to get you on Christian Doctors Digest. But before we get to the main topic, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background. You have a very fascinating background in healthcare.
Yeah, again, when you're old, you've likely done a lot of things in life, and God's allowed me to practice for a long time, so I'd say my practice life has sort of been divided into at least three sections, none of which seem very related to each other, but all of which, to me, sort of a continuum of God taking a man and changing him and gradually molding him into something else that was more significant as the years went by. So, yeah, I think I told you I grew up telling people I was going to be a doctor, but I really didn't know much about what that meant. And I sort of wingled my way through undergrad and went to the University of Illinois to medical school. Somewhere along the line, decided I didn't want to be a surgeon. I think it was after staying up all night doing Whipple procedures three nights at Cook County Hospital or something.
That'll do it to you.
that was enough to decide not to operate. And I decided I was going to be an internist. And I came down to Wilford Hall here, and I actually went on active duty as an Air Force officer while I was in medical school, which was a major decision for me to actually pick up a 9-year commitment while I was in school. It was the first year they ever offered that program, and my wife and I wanted to have kids while we were young. I pulled the paper out of the wastebasket, filled out a few lines, and within a few weeks was on active duty going to medical school in Chicago, and had a good experience up there, but picked up a 9-year commitment. And so when it came time for internship, I could have gone to a civilian program, but they gave me my best opportunity, told me if I was any good, they'd let me stay for my entire residency in the Air Force training program at Wilford Hall. And so I came to San Antonio, not knowing much about San Antonio or Texas, nor about medicine for that matter, but entered into the internal medicine residency program out there. Because I owed him a long time, I just kept staying. And I was the chief resident for a year and taught and took my boards and then did a two-year fellowship in nephrology, not because I was so interested in nephrology, but because the staff guys were the best guys at Wilford Hall at that time, wonderful teachers, guys who've gone on to be chairmen of departments and things. And so I did 2 years of nephrology, and about shortly before that, the Medicare bill was passed that, you know, approved the care of renal disease by all of us taxpayers. And so by the time I was a fellow in nephrology, I was moonlighting for a guy here in San Antonio and began running dialysis clinics. And my vision during that time was that God was going to allow me to start dialysis clinics in little towns all over South Texas so that people wouldn't have to drive for their three-day-a-week treatments. And I had always told people before I was going to be a missionary to Africa like you had been, but somehow my African mission got rerouted, and I got changed to, I said, from black Central Africa to brown Southwest Texas, and began taking care of people mostly with diabetic renal disease in little towns out, you know, 100 miles west of San Antonio. Did get to start a lot of dialysis clinics. My partner and I kind of oversaw the startup of, I think, 15 different dialysis programs in various small towns, and a number in San Antonio. Gradually migrated. My Wilford Hall program had been the only transplant program in South Texas when I was a fellow, and so I learned a lot about renal transplantation and came out and held, with a couple of other guys, founded a renal transplant program by the late 70s. That was they didn't have one over at our medical school, but we did a civilian, non-academic transplant program that continues to this time. By the time I bailed, we'd done 3,000 kidney transplants and another 300 heart transplants. We'd kind of branched off into that. You know, once you're into immunosuppression and management of drugs and medicines, you can do a lot. So that's the evolution of my practice. But in the mid-1980s, or I should say in the late 70s, my partner and I went to a national meeting where a guy was selling a canned obesity program using protein-sparing modified fasting. And we thought it was a kind of a novel idea, you know, eating 500 calories of diet supplements a day and feeding people protein with essentially nothing else. And we ended up being a proprietary obesity program, the first one in South Texas. And there were about 40 nephrologists around the country who opened such places under the auspices of National Medical Care. And that was my first entrance into the area that we'll call wellness or health. And I was kind of bored by it, didn't know much about obesity, didn't care very much about it. We're more interested in working in the ICU, taking care of, you know, transplant patients and dialysis patients. And so I kept doing the obesity program on the side with my partners and didn't pay much attention to it. And we tried to get out of it. And I think I told you, in 1985, we found a guy with a little program called Health by Design down at the YMCA, an executive exam program. And we talked him into coming out and running our obesity program and his executive exam program, put $10,000 a piece into a bucket to form the new company. And he was with us about 3 or 4 months and told us he was leaving and going to Austin. And I told my partners I just couldn't stand to lose that 10 grand that quickly and that I would go. I prayed about it, I think, but, you know, I think it was mostly the 10 grand, quite honestly. And so I took over the running of his little executive exam program and our obesity program, not liking the latter and not knowing very much about executive exams. He had a Whitmore volume meter to do underwater weights, to do body composition. I knew nothing about that. He had a treadmill. I'd never treadmilled anybody in my life, even though, you know, I'd taken care of a lot of cardiovascular disease. And so it was a new experience for me. But it was interesting. Within a few weeks, it began to capture me. I began to realize that this was really a chance to assess the health of somebody and to educate them when they came back for their summary conference 2 weeks later. Dr. Vandal had set up that kind of program, and he always handed them a 20-page booklet. And in those days, it was shorter, but by the time I got through with it with all my verbosity, we began having, you know, 15, 20, 25-page charts full of data. And And I got captured by that program, Dave. It changed me. I was going through a time where I was making a lot of money, and I was, but I was seeing an incredible expenditure of cash on the brokenness of people, without any effort being made at any place to educate the public as to how to not be so sick. And I often said it occurred to me in the early 80s, I had three dialysis patients who spent over $1 million of taxpayer money in their last year of life, and none of them had ever worked at any time in his or her life.
Hmm.
And I said, you know, that will never work. And me, who had a mortgage and four kids and a dog and a, you know, car payment and so forth, I said, we'll go broke if we do that. And there were only three ways to save money in medicine, I perceived at that time. One was to not pay the doctor so much, which is called managed care. And the second was to deny care based on age, race, sex, creed, or some other artificial criteria that doesn't sound very good to us. And the third way, of course, was to not get so ill. And so I began to address the issue of how in the world can we ever not get so ill.
What was the impact of that, David? I mean, you know, I mean, on your patients and stuff, because you, not too long after that, moved away from nephrology almost completely, I mean, over the years.
Well, I did over the years. Unfortunately, I was going to go broke doing the wellness stuff, and so I had to keep working with my nephrology buddies. I signed out of my nephrology practice as a partner, but took over this little health by design company that didn't make enough money to pay my debt and ultimately ended up in bankruptcy and other things. But the fact was that I was going through a time of spiritual change, and I knew that God had put me in this place to alter the way primary care was done in our community. I didn't know how it was going to work. I simply knew that somehow we had to get to a kind of primary care whose major thrust was education and whose minor thrust was taking care of sickness.
Mm-hmm.
And so coming out of that executive exam experience, I began to realize that the people that I was examining in this little program increasingly were guys who were leading companies, officers of several of our major corporations in San Antonio. And I thought to myself, well, this is it. You go take care of the boss and you become his primary caregiver, and maybe he'll let you go back into the company and teach health to people. Some of it, of course, I didn't know much about what health meant, but gradually I evolved this system where, and it took a long time for me to come to it, that if you have good body composition and you have good nutrition and you have good fitness and you don't get poisoned by things and you have good spiritual health, that you likely will live quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
You'll do okay. I evolved through every one of those stages. You know, just don't be fat was the first one. Have good muscle mass. The second one was make sure you have good protein nutrition. The third, which I was always coming out of nephrology with that, because we were, you know, hooking up TPN lines to people all the time and stuff. And the third one was be physically fit and active. And again, guys like Dr. Cooper and Paffenbarger and others published papers, you know, documenting the relationship between activity and longevity and total calories burned and longevity, as well as fitness and longevity. And then the fourth one, the don't get poisoned, is one where I've really been hung up now for 20 years. It became apparent to me by the mid-80s that most of the chronic diseases of mankind, the stuff I took care of, like Wegener's granulomatosis and arteritis of various kinds, probably started in the gut with the changes in bacterial flora and immune system activity in the gut. And I kind of held to that, and I didn't invent that. You know, I had read books like The Yeast Connection, and when Helicobacter finally came on the scene in the late 80s, and the guys won the Nobel Prize for finding that gut bacteria cause everything from lymphomas to ulcers to you name it, I was pretty sure that poisoning was both external poisoning from smoke and alcohol and various other kinds of negative environmental chemicals, but poisoning also was finally from within in people, related to somewhat to their diet, somewhat to their flora, somewhat to aging of the gut. And I still believe that and write about it and talk about it quite a lot. Anyway, that became a five-part, how do you stay well, was good body composition, good nutrition, good fitness, don't be poisoned, and have good spiritual health. And take time to measure something every year or two to find out how you're doing in those areas. And that's what a health by design exam became, was basically a published 20-page document that was purported to educate people in those disciplines.
David, you know, they've then morphed in one of the things you talked about initially with executives to where you now have a growing and enlarging network of in-company health services with an emphasis on prevention as well as taking care of disease. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a great blessing. I can't tell you that I figured it all out that way, although, again, I knew from meeting with these guys who were, you know, presidents of companies. USAA was my chief first company, you know. I had all these general officers and people who were there, and I enjoyed meeting them and spending time with them and taking care of them on the side, doing whatever limited primary care they needed. I took care of it, and they had my cell phones. And I perceived that the way that we were going to change the healthcare model toward an educational model rather than a simple primary care of disease model was that they were going to take me back into their company to let me teach their people all that same stuff that I just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, we were going to have to develop quality assessments for all their people, and it couldn't be too expensive or they wouldn't buy it. And I kept my prices really, really low so nobody else would even get in the business. And so, you know, I was sort of doing things for free most of the time, but I was working nephrology on the side, so I had an income. So I was doing both this wellness program as well as continuing to manage dialysis clinics in little towns, but was no longer a partner with any kind of a partner in the nephrology business. But anyway, the executives became to me a way that if I cared for them well, they might take me back into their company. USAA never did all that I thought they were going to. They would have if they'd have kept their same HR staff, but the guy who was the head of HR who kind of ordained my program in the first place retired, and things changed over there. And ultimately, the company that God sent me to was Valero, the big refiner. And their CEOs have been my patients now for a long time. And Valero did take us back in 2000 and let us start a clinic inside their building. The clinic, basically, we were a vendor, and we had a space, and we provided free health services to all their people. And they paid so many dollars an hour to have a doctor and a nurse there. Well, now we've been at Valero now for 15 years in that kind of a model. We have two full-time physicians who are there 8 hours a day and probably four or five nurses who work there, a couple of nurses who do nothing but teach health, nothing but work on obesity and nutrition and fitness and avoidance of poisons. And our average ROI for Valero for many, many months, Dave, has been about $250,000 a month that we save them.
Wow.
In productivity, absenteeism, and copays. So it's an incredible model of cost savings. Not only that, but their overall cost of health has been diminishing for a long time because the people are growing in education and knowledge. And we have courses, and of course our obesity program migrated over the years to become college-level courses in the management of body composition and both doing DEXA scans and other things to look at composition and then working hard on muscle mass and bone mass and fat mass. And gradually God has given us new studies like following, you know, fasting insulin levels along with sugar levels to find the guy who's, you know, who's 10 years early in his type 2 diabetes. You know, the first inkling of type 2 diabetes isn't when your glucose tolerance test is bad. Your first inkling is when your insulin level goes from 2 to 5 fasting,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you put 2 pounds of fat in your liver this year. And once guys understand that, I think you'll see people who are staying leaner and more fit and not letting the 5 pounds go into their liver and get fat. And so God has given new technologies and more sophisticated ways to look earlier and earlier at the things that ultimately cause our death and cause vascular disease.
David, tell me about what it looks like now. So it started with that company. You've continued to grow and expand.
Yes, we have. And again, I think we're just barely getting going. We have about 10 companies that we're currently dialoguing with right now that want to do the same thing that Valero's done. We've been in Valero for 15 years. We've been with one of their spinoff companies called NuStar for the last 5 or 6 or 7 years since they opened. We've been at an insurance company called UMR, which is a side shoot of United Healthcare. We are in 5 different Valero refineries where we take care of up to 1,000 people or so in the refinery with a physician. Many of these clinics are part-time clinics, Dave. Some of them are 4 hours a day. We have started as small as 2 hours a day of physician time. The big Valero clinic is 8 hours a day. We have a clinic over at the airport at a company that services Delta and FedEx jets. Again, a largely blue-collar company, and it's been a long saga of trying to get those people up to health standards. Many of the people, when we first went in there, hadn't seen a doctor for 20 years, you know, kind of a GED, less than high school education population of workers. And many of them just have no knowledge of healthcare at all, had never been screened for anything. So gradually that company is growing and improving its health. And I anticipate that, down the line, that almost all large corporations will have in-house clinics funded almost the same way that ours are, basically where the clinic is a vendor for the business and provides physician services for 2, 4, 6, or 8 hours a day with nursing education services in place. The people get all free health care, basically, as long as they're working for that company. They get referred out. They still have insurance policies, and they still get referred out to consultants and go to hospitals when they get real sick. But the vast majority of people cared for in this system don't get so ill, get care early, get care consistently. It's loving care. I think the neatest thing of it is, as I told you, is that the physicians who work there just love what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what's happening all over the country, of course. Our primary care physicians love going to work. We sort of define their operation as seeing no more than 3 people an hour, most of the time 2 people an hour. They have time to love on the people and care for them. They'll see them again tomorrow. If you screwed it up today, you know, you'll know it by tomorrow, you know, if the guy didn't get better. And the consulting system works well for calling an ER or calling an ENT guy or a surgeon or somebody and having them see your patient the same day. People are very responsive to our physicians in these clinics. So at the moment, we only have maybe eight or nine clinics, but it could be twice that many within the next 2 years. And, of course, all it would take would be one company like USAA or somebody who has, you know, 20,000 employees in one building they would require, you know, just a huge clinic operation or multiple clinic sites within their building to serve their people. But the people love what they've happened. The Valero people, I think one of the reasons Valero was named the outstanding corporation in America a few years ago for which to work had to do with their clinic and medical operation, that the people love what happens to them there, and our physicians love being involved in it and doing it. And that's a joy for me. And, of course, on a Christian Doctors Network, I'd have to say again that my goal for this always has been that we put a believer in the chair where mm-hmm. the people are.
Yeah.
And the believers can, in certain circumstances, then, if for somebody who needs prayer or wants prayer, somebody needs to talk about deep things of life, have a physician who is a believer who can talk to them about such things. But we don't go into the companies with that on our sleeve. We're very upfront about our core values, which, you know, I think you probably saw them when you were here. You know, we are about extraordinary pursuits shaped by our faith. We believe that compassion shapes the way we care, that we believe in good medicine. Everybody must win, meaning the businesses, the doctors, the patients, the providers, everybody. And then last, that we're radically passionate about genuine healing.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the four core things around which we work. And our system lets us do it.
Sure.
That's the in-clinic stuff.
Yeah, and it's so neat, David. The patients come in, they're not worried about paying. You as physicians and the healthcare team aren't worried about collecting or filing insurance.
It's just a marvelous system. I feel like I died and went to heaven in medicine, you know, like I just never, the whole issue of finances never comes up. And even out here in our executive examination center, which I consider to only be a prototypic model of the way a business assessment center should look, where the business assessment center would sit down the hill from the clinic. And the same doctors who work in the clinic would also go do assessments of health in the assessment center where they have mm-hmm. a DEXA scanner and a carotid Doppler equipment and a treadmill and maybe do some of the things we do on these big executive exams and then publish a document every year. Every patient on his birthday would get to do that kind of assessment done mostly by the physician who might have an opportunity to see him later in the year with a cold or the flu or a sore shoulder or a bladder infection or something else. So it's a model that isn't in perfect order yet, but probably will be before long, and we're going to get opportunities to experiment around and see what works. But primary care, as you know, is a mixture of three things to me, and one of them has been sorely neglected. The second one hasn't been done too well. The three things, of course, are assessment of health, and there's all kinds of equipment and blood studies and things you can do there. The second one, of course, is education, which has been terribly neglected. Basically, and there you need to have courses, which is what I do, of course, is write course material for patients to learn. And the third is, of course, care of sickness. You know, when you get sick, we'll take care of you. There's an outfit up in Milwaukee, QuadMed. It has a wonderful motto that says, you know, we're going to work our darndest to keep you well. And if you get sick, we'll take care of that, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, I think, is the right model for most of us who are ministers of medicine, is that we want you to be well. But if you get sick, God has given us wisdom about how to do that also. And we'll do the best we can with that. And that's what we believe. And that isn't our motto at Health by Design, but it's our creed. It's what we believe in. And I still believe that as we educate the public to know almost as much as you know about certain disciplines, that the public will stay weller and not end up in doctor's offices quite so early with quite so much bad stuff.
David, it's been delightful to talk to you, and I think I can hear the wheels in people's minds going as they're listening to this. And thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule, because I think people are looking for new models, and not only ones that will make a real difference in people's lives, and secondly, ones that are not so frenetic and frantic and pushed by business models. The interesting thing about yours is very simple approach, but it's inside of business, businesses instead of the business of medicine. So it's been very instructive for all of us. Thank you for being with us. I so appreciate it.
Great to be with you. And if anybody is ever interested and wants to give us a call, we'll be glad to talk to them about it. And I think one of our roles will be educating people as to how to get this done. So that they, because God has called a lot of us to medicine, but a lot of guys hate what they're doing, don't like it because it's killing them. And you don't really get to be the minister you were called to be when you're in an economic system that isn't any good. So this is a system that works, and if anybody wants to know about it, we'll be glad to talk to them.
We'll put number in the Christian Doctor's Digest companion. I suspect you're going to get some calls. Thanks, David.
Be wonderful, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Wow, great interview, wasn't it? And if you'd like to get a hold of David, just go to the CDD Companion. Don't throw that thing away. Give him a buzz. He'd be happy to talk to you, and I'm sure can give you some great advice. Hey, grab your calendar. I know you can't come to all these events, but you should come to at least one or two. And here's the lineup. November 13th through the 14th, Grace Prescription Seminar, led by Walt Learmore, Bill Peel in Indianapolis, Indiana. You need a tune-up if you went to the Saline Solution, because this is the expanded, better version. And if you haven't been, you need to go. In fact, if you come, bring a colleague, bring a friend, or even your pastor. What a time that would be to have together. February 14th through the 21st is the CMDA Winter Cruise. And there's actually two tracks you can take. One, you can be with Dr. Richard Swenson, and he's going to be talking about some keys to living above circumstances. And then we have another track, Marriage Enrichment Conference, run by our Marriage Commission. So bring your spouse and go through that track if you want to. It's a time of restoration, renewal, fun, fellowship, great food. Mark those dates you need to write down. February 14th through 21st, I'll be there. I hope you are as well. And then the CMDA National Convention, April 21st through the 24th at Ridgecrest Conference Center next year. Now, if you've not been to a national meeting, you've really missed something. It's a great time of networking, sitting around at meals and meeting new people and getting to know them, and marvelous speakers. Dr. John Patrick's going to be there this year. Johnny Erickson Todd is going to be speaking. And then Vishal Magalwadi, you've probably not heard of him. He's from India. He is a tremendous Bible teacher. I've heard him speak. He'll be doing our Bible teaching each morning. There's children's program, youth program, all sorts of great things to be part of. Commissions are meeting, the exhibitors there. It's just a marvelous time. And I encourage you to come, bring a friend. We'll have a great time together. To register for any of these conferences, just go to cmda.org. Or if you've got questions, give us a call on our toll-free number, 888-230-2637. It's always a joy to have good friends join us on Christian Doctors Digest, and Ron Blue is one of those. He's been a speaker for us. He's been supportive of CMDA for many years. He's the founder of Kingdom Advisors, a ministry that empowers Christian financial advisors who seek to integrate biblical worldview into their advice and counsel. In 1979, he founded Ron Blue and Company, which became the largest Christian financial planning firm in the country. He's authored over 18 books, including Master Your Money, The Complete Guide to Faith-Based Family Finances, and many more. In fact, we're going to be talking about two of those today. One is How Much is Enough? And the other is Splitting Heirs, really talking about passing on money to the next generation and what is the wise thing to do. Ron holds a Bachelor of Science and MBA from Indiana University. He's married to Judy, and they have 5 grown children, 13 grandchildren, and they reside in Atlanta, Georgia. You know, when I get asked how many grandchildren I have one response: not enough. Well, Ron's got me way beat. Well, let's get together and catch up with Ron and see what he can share with us. Ron, let's talk about how much is enough. In our economy, I think people are more nervous than they've ever been, and that includes physicians with and dentists with enormous amount of changes happening in healthcare and how it's delivered and how it's financed, and people are feeling more overworked and less satisfied, and a lot of them are making less. And how much is enough, and how do we get this in perspective according to how the Bible teaches us about this?
Well, how much is enough is a question that is unique to everybody, and it kind of begs a second question: enough for what?
Yeah.
Okay, so you have to say, well, what is it that you're wanting to fund? And there are so many variables then that enter into it. It is legitimate to say, okay, in an ideal situation, what is the end game in terms of the lifestyle that we would like to have, the giving we would like to have, helping our children if that's something, or paying off our mortgage? So defining the finish lines in terms of perhaps values or goals, and then back up and put a quantitative number on it. You can come up with a quantitative number, but most people live with the kind of the insecurity of, I don't think I have enough. But they've never compared what they have, what they're likely to have, and what they would like to have. So there's a little bit of work to answer that question, how much is enough? And the biggest driver of it is lifestyle.
You know, I think as we talk to Christians, we know some of God's principles on money, but the tendency to think in the back of our mind is, well, I just need more. What
yeah.
if? What if? What if the economy just went to pot? What if the stock market just bottomed out? What if it was the 1930s? You know, and we got to find our security not in what our asset line is.
Well, we've had a little bit of experience in the last 7 years.
Yeah.
And I think we can draw some lessons from the experience. In 2008 and 2009, we had the biggest collapse since the Depression. And every asset class crashed, and it was worldwide. So all of a sudden, nothing was what it was planned to be or projected to be. And I had a Merrill Lynch advisor who advises clients $50 million and up in net worth. And he himself has done well financially, and he lost 50% of his retirement plan in 2008.
Wow!
In terms of devaluation. We had put him through Kingdom Advisor training, and we'd given him 5 principles to manage his money. Said number one, and these were principles that I shared at a congressional testimony in the early 90s when Senator Dodd, he asked me the question, what would I tell the American family? I said, Senator, I would tell them to spend less than they earn, to avoid the use of debt, 3, build liquidity or margin or flexibility into their financial plan, 4, set long-term goals so that you know how to prioritize the short-term versus the long-term. And what I didn't say, but would say subsequent to that, and that is to give generously.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at those 5 principles, And I've applied those five principles, and this Merrill Lynch advisor had applied those five principles. He and his wife said, well, we're living within our income. We don't have any debt. We've got cash in the bank. We know what our long-term goals are, and we're continuing to give generously. So what could we have done to avoid this? And the answer was nothing.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing. You can only do what only you can do. If I'm counseling somebody relative to their financial planning, I would say follow those five money management principles as a lifestyle so that you're then doing everything that you can do. And how you apply those principles will change over time because it's different for those who have young children and those who have adult children, for example, in terms of what the long-term needs are.
Mm-hmm.
But if you follow those five principles, you will have done everything that you can to plan for the uncertainty of the future. And there are five biblical principles that are never, ever going to change, and Wall Street has no answer better than those five, period.
Yeah, yeah. And then you rest, I think, is the other side of the coin, Ron, and that is that real security doesn't come from that. I mean, if you put all your trust in the fact that now I'm automatically going to be secure because financially because I follow these principles. God doesn't promise that. And it really comes from, you know, you rest in Him and don't have anxiety. Let's go to the other end of the equation, which I know a lot of our members are thinking about as they move towards their 60s, 70s, and that is financial planning. What are they going to do with the money they have? And I know many of our members have very large and significant retirement accounts where they've put a lot of money to tax shelter it and plan for retirement. But someday they're going to be gone and their spouse is going to be gone and they're going to be looking to what to do with this money and making those plans now. Take us through some of those principles. You outlined them so clearly in Splitting Heirs, which I love that book. The title is great.
Well, I think the first question that everybody has to ask and answer is who's going to get it? Because the government can get it, charity can get it, or your heirs can get it.
Mm-hmm.
And those really are the only three choices. If you want to leave everything to charity, the government and your children are going to get nothing. If you want to leave everything to your children, the government's going to get a share and charity's not going to get much. And if you want to leave half to charity and half to your children, the government's share is reduced dramatically. It's kind of if you look at it that way in a pie chart, really, you can pick any one of the three or a combination of the three in the end. But here's the question that I think is so important. When Judy and I were going through our first thinking about where we wanted to leave wealth, our children were in their 20s and 30s, and the Lord had blessed us, so we had some money. I'd built a business, and it had some value. And we asked ourselves three questions. If we left, let's just pick a number. If we left $1 million to child number one, what's the worst thing that could happen?
Hmm.
And then we asked the second question was, well, how serious is that? And third, how likely is it to occur? So, for example, we had one child that was a very generous giver, and we said, if we left $1 million to him, what's the worst thing that could happen? He'd give it all away. Well, how serious is that? That's not very serious. How likely is it to occur? 100%. So we looked at that and we said, okay, that's a good decision. We looked at another one of our children and we said, if we left $1 million to that child, what's the worst thing that could happen? And she was married to a young man who had grown up poor and was committed to supporting his family. We said, if we died, left $1 million to him, it would take away his need to provide for that family. Well, how serious is that? And we said, that's really serious. And how likely is it to occur? It's very likely to occur. So we processed that for almost 2 years, and then we had a single mother-daughter, and her needs were different. Point being this, if you don't ask the right question, you can't get the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
And the right question is, what's the worst thing that could happen if I leave this money to a child or children? How likely is it to occur, and how serious is it? And then another principle that I would follow is do your giving while you're living so you're knowing where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
So be that charitable giving or even to your children. Think about wealth transfer as opposed to estate planning. In other words, when's the best time to transfer that wealth? It may not be at death. It may be before death.
For not only personal reasons, but also for government reasons to deal with it early so it doesn't all go in bulk at one time. What about when you say that it stimulates the question, you know, the kind of the principle, well, I'm going to treat all my children the same, I love them all the same, and, you know, that type of thing. And what you're really saying is that may not be the wise thing to do. Expand on that a little bit.
Well, I have another principle, and that is if you love your children equally, you will treat them uniquely.
Hmm.
And I think that is the way God treats us. He loves each of us equally, but does he treat us all the same? Absolutely not. He treats us uniquely because he knows what our needs are. So I think a biblical principle is loving your children equally does not mean that you give them equally. For example, let's say that you have a handicapped grandchild, or like we had a single mom daughter. Their needs would be significantly different than a physician's son, for example. So treating them equally may not be the best use of the resources that God has given you. I'm not saying don't treat them equally, but I'm saying don't make that the default.
Yeah.
Think that one through.
When I was reading your book, that came to mind because one of my kids and her husband are missionaries in Africa. He's a dentist, but, you know, the career they're on, they're very unlikely to have much of retirement when they get done with it and to live on or a house to live in or anything else. So I really appreciate that principle when I read it because I think it is wiser, and we need biblical wisdom in this area in particular.
You know what? We need biblical wisdom on all these decisions, and God promises to give it to us.
Yeah, that's a good thing, and his principles are clear when you look for them, and you've done such a wonderful job in expanding those into our lives as you've communicated over the years in your speaking and writing. What about talking about this with your kids? And, you know, I think I was actually writing my kids yesterday. I didn't even see this was on my schedule today, Ron, to do this. And I was going through and updating the widow's file yesterday for my wife and, you know, looking at our assets and where everything was and, you know, make sure it was all in the lockbox. And then wrote a letter to the kids and said, now, here's where the keys are for the lockbox. If mom and I both get killed, here's, you know, you need to know this. You know, those type of issues are something we should come back to. And in that note, I talked to them some about this, even though they're all in their 30s now. You know, when's the right time to start talking about this? How important is it to be transparent?
Oh, I think by the time they reach their 30s, obviously they're adults and they're raising their own families and can process that. I would say one thing, though, that our oldest now is approaching 50. And what I have observed is that the thinking and the needs and what I know changes over time.
Yeah.
So what I decided when they were 30 is not necessarily what I would decide when they're 50.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggies that happens is that the longer you live and the older your children get, the less they really need the money.
Yeah.
So where it's going to end up then is in that next generation, potentially, or even into the fourth generation. And that's a whole new set of questions that come up. So thinking about how you're going to steward your estate is like financial planning. It's an ongoing process. You don't do it and put it away. You come back and review it on a regular basis and continue to ask the questions and continue to ask God for his wisdom.
You know, my mom's in her late 80s now, and she just moved into assisted living a couple of years ago and sold her condo. And when she got done, she took that money and gave each of the grandkids a generous gift, $10,000, because she knew each one of them were in a stage in their life where that was going to be an enormous blessing to them right now.
Right.
With, you know, educational debt and kids that they had and all the rest of it. And so I thought that was so wise. I was so glad to see it. And she just went right past the rest of us and said, "This is for you. And I want to use it well." And it was a good test as well, you know,
sure,
to what they were going to do with that money. So it was great. Ron, anything else you want to share with us? Just so many good principles here. I just want to sit and keep talking, but we're going to have to close this off. But anything else you'd like to share before we close?
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about my now 45-year career in finances and 35 working with Christians. And I can sum up what I know and believe, and that is that God's Word is authoritative at all times, under all circumstances, for all financial planning and financial decision-making. because he gives us wisdom for the process and principles for the decisions. And so you can trust him. And when Wall Street works, it's because they're using God's principles. They just don't know it.
Yeah, yeah. Where can people get more information if they want to dig into this? I would encourage them to get copies of your, I think, 11 books or maybe more by now, but for your books for your kids and books for you and books about estate planning. You just got the whole spectrum, and all of them come back to the same thing, the answers God has for you. Any other resources if people want to get personal advice? Are you still working with Kingdom Advisors?
Yes, I'm working with Kingdom Advisors, but I've also set up the Ron Blue Institute for Financial Planning, which is at Indiana Wesleyan University. So the Ron Blue Institute, you can begin to find some things there as we populate that, which is where all my intellectual property is going to end up. You can go on a website called idisciple.org, which has a Ron Blue Institute channel. So there's various places in it. I've got a lot of thoughts that about how we're going to get the content out there on a more usable basis over the next couple of years. So hopefully people will hear about it if they're interested.
Sounds great. Ron, thank you so much
you
for
bet.
Being with us. I appreciate it.
I appreciate being asked.
Wow, it's always great to have Ron on, and he is a wealth of information after many years of working in this area, and a real trusted resource. What he says is the gospel, because he shares God's principles in everything that he does. Well, you know, as we wrap up this issue, I want to encourage you to think about the financial end and think about CMDA. You know, I'm re-looking at my estate plan, and Jody and I are getting ready to redo it, and you may be wanting to do the same. And I encourage you to remember CMDA like I'm going to, because there's no other organization that is available to help with the future of Christian healthcare in this country, and to raise up the next generation, to ensure Christian medical missions, which is so essential to penetrating those 1040 window countries, those difficult-to-access places. CMDA is right there. And then speaking your concerns to the church, to the media, to the government on religious liberty and all the rest of it. I want to make sure that continues. It's important to me, and I hope it's important to you. Estate planning is a great way to give a larger gift than you might be able to in any other way that'll really help ensure that future. It'll help build some of our endowments, help us to do new things, expand what we're doing already. The biggest challenge we face at CMDA is not lack of ideas. I've got plenty of ideas, and it's not lack of great ministries. I've got superb ministries that we're doing here at the organization. So many people involved, over 2,500 volunteers. But always the limiting factor is the resources that we need to create a new resource we want to get out, to hire a new person that could really take that area of ministry to a whole new level. And so finances are part of it. That's why there's so much written about money in the Bible. And I'm not one to shy away from that topic, because what we hold dearest to us can often be our finances, which God says, no, we should put our money where our hearts are. And that is into his work. And I want to do that well, and I trust you do as well. Jamie is happy to help you, as I mentioned before, in that area without any obligation or any expectation on our part. And in fact, we finished our discussion here in the studio. He said, hey, listen, tell people if anyone calls me, I'll send them a copy of Splitting Heirs, which is a great resource. And that'll be something that'll help you in this area. You know, but our joy to put that into your hands. Well, I trust God's continuing to use you. I know you're facing many stresses and issues in your practice, in your family. You're in our prayers, you're in our thoughts. We're always thinking how we can better hold up your hands in this difficult time in healthcare to help you be effective and successful at what God's called you to do. If you've got ideas or things you'd love to pass on to me, speakers you think we should have on Christian Doctors Digest or whatever, just drop me a note at executive@cmda.org, and we'll take those into consideration, and you may hear one of your favorite speakers or a topic you're interested in on a future issue of Christian Doctors Digest. May God bless you till we get a chance to get together again.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations.